Following a near-fatal car accident, a world-famous novelist finds himself in a strange house, being nursed back to health by his doting, self-proclaimed number one fan. But as her love for his work turns into dangerous obsession, he realizes he must plot his greatest story yet, how to escape with his life. Stephen King's best-selling novel, Misery, was adapted for the screen in 1990, directed by Rob Reiner and starring James Caan as Paul Sheldon and Kathy Bates as Annie Wilkes, in an Academy Award and Golden Globe winning performance. Misery is back in a new Broadway adaptation written by two-time Academy Award winner William Goldman, with action film star Bruce Willis making his Broadway debut as Paul Sheldon, and Laurie Metcalf picking up Annie Wilkes' bottles of Novril and Sledgehammer. The production is directed by Will Frears. I spoke with Will in New York recently and began by asking how he first heard about this project.
In the sort of most classic way possible, my agent called me, and he said, what are you doing next week? And I said, I'm busy next week because on Sunday night, my wife's going into hospital. She's being induced and we're supposed to have a child on Monday. And he said, What about later in the week? And I said, why? And he said that he had gotten a call that Warner Brothers were interested in doing Misery and they were interested in talking to me. And he thought it was a great idea. And could I make myself available for a meeting? And he said he would try and get it as late in the week as possible. And I said, okay. And I sat, my now oldest daughter was born on the Monday, and I sat with her like asleep on my chest when she was, you know, 7 hours old, reading this book with a look of horror on my face. And that was how it came about. And so I went and I met with people at Warner Brothers and the people at Castle Rock, and I started working with Bill Goldman. And that was 4.5 years ago now, and we've just sort of wonderfully kind of slowly just sort of worked our way to getting it here. That it's been a very slow, enjoyably slow process, that it was never thought that like the best thing to do was hurry and get something wrong. It was like, we'll take the time to get the script right. And we did it out of town in Pennsylvania and learned a great deal from that, and then sort of pulled it all apart again and started again and finally got a script to the point where we thought, oh, we can get the actors we want here. And the first actor we went out to was Bruce Willis. And he came and did a reading. And then we said, do you want to have lunch? And we were having lunch. And then sort of 20 minutes into lunch, when we were sort of like making small talk, he said, by the way, I want to do this. And suddenly we all kind of leapt to our feet with delight. Once you have Bruce, you have a theater and you have, and it just goes. And then Laurie came on board when we lost Elizabeth Marvel, whose House of Cards dates didn't work out. And then we got Laurie Metcalf.
How did you work with William Goldman to create what you've created together?
Well, what's amazing about Bill, I just feel slightly name-droppy calling him Bill, but that is what he calls himself, is, you know, I went sort of ready to do whatever he wanted, assuming that he would be in charge and, you know, he's William Goldman and I'm not, and mm-hmm. that I would do it as he wished. And he made it very, very clear from the beginning. He said, I work for you. Tell me what you want. So we really just kind of worked together. We went out to lunch a lot. One of the great pleasures of working with Bill is the food is really good. And we would talk about the show and we would talk about the movie and how to move from one to the other. And he's a great man. And part of what's so great about him is he's incredibly, I don't want to say humble because that implies that I might know more than him and I don't. Mm-hmm. But he's willing to listen to your bad ideas and get a good idea out of it. And that's sort of what I meant, is that we worked out how to turn it into a play and how to reframe it and how... The movie's brilliant, but how to not copy it and how to sort of deal, how to embrace, not deal, actually, the opposite, how to take the limitations of the stage and turn that around so that it was actually things that were working to our advantage and to allow us to tell a new story. And we just sort of did that, and we kept saying, well, what's the story we're telling? And then we finally worked out what the story was, and then he sort of wrote it all down, and I said, thank you. He never once, and he should have probably endlessly, I mean, he would tell me I would have stupid ideas all the time, mm-hmm. but he never once sort of made me feel like he wasn't listening to me. It was a wonderful, easy collaboration. So it was just a kind of pleasure. And then we would talk about basketball.
You mentioned there are limitations of the stage. How do you put anything for any show, any story, how do you put it on a stage? What were some of the particular considerations you had to work with for Misery?
The great joke of the thing is that people keep saying, oh, that's great for a play. There's two people stuck on stage in a room. And you go, actually, you know what's great for a play is like a king who has three daughters and he says who loves them. And it goes everywhere. It's not helpful being stuck in bed. So that was sort of the main thing, was to say, well, there's this guy stuck in bed. So we have to make it a play about a man stuck in bed. And once we understood that, and that there couldn't be a more exciting or more interesting play happening not in his room, you had to deal with, he was going to be in bed, and the play had to be about, in some sense, how he was going to get out of bed. And then again, once you embrace that limitation, then you start thinking about, like, well, what happens when he gets out? If it's that claustrophobic for him, how do we mirror that claustrophobia for the audience? The feeling of being stuck in bed, the feeling of being ill, of being kept prisoner, all of those things, like, in some way that's not dissimilar to being stuck in a theatre. Like, you're stuck there, you can't leave, you feel like people are watching you, you don't want to make a noise. So once you embrace that kind of, that limitation, then suddenly actually you're kind of completely liberated to understand how you can tell the story. Whereas I think that had we spent a lot of time trying to get him out of bed too soon, or moving the bed around, or, I mean, we worry about staticness and we do a lot to compensate for it, but if we started making it movement-y, lots of movement and lots of people busy, then it would lose the thing it's about, which is about being stuck. And you can't cut, you can't edit, you can't change the angle to make something scary, so you have to find a different way to keep looking, and then you start getting interested in the idea of a kind of cinematic idea, and you think about, like, well, what would a tracking shot look like on stage? How does he move through the house? And suddenly, once you're interested in those questions, then the answers become kind of thrilling. And you get excited by the problem of the claustrophobia, rather than taking it on as like, oh, well, if we could only solve the claustrophobia, then we'd be good. Like, if only we didn't have this claustrophobia. And instead you say, well, this is awesome. We're totally claustrophobic. The audience has to look. And now we can do anything. Now that we've obeyed that rule, we're free. And so it was really, I mean, there are endless limitations. There's a man stuck in bed, and you have to worry about every prop that gets on and off stage and all of those things. But they're really interesting problems to have to solve, and they force you. You can only solve them all by going more truthful. You can't bring in a curtain or a drop or a thing. You have to explain how all the movement works, how people get from one place to the other, what the geography of the space is. And the set designer did it brilliantly. And he would just get it more and more brilliant. Each time he'd say, I don't want to give away too much, but he could sort of say, I can get this tighter, I can get even more of it in here. And then he did that, and then it does the things it does. And you just think, well, because you've been so claustrophobic, it suddenly feels like the kind of, you suddenly go into CinemaScope for a minute, and then you come back to the claustrophobia. So working in that becomes an interesting challenge rather than, oh, if only we didn't have to do this.
The set designer is David Corns. He's incredible. Yeah. The set's out. I mean, it's not, as you say, it does what you need it to do. It's not like it's distracting. It's just perfectly in place for what it is. How often do you have to interact with him? Or how much of it does he sort of find on his own because he is so good at what he does?
We've been friends for nearly 20 years. So
well, that'll help.
Yeah, and so we interact quite a lot because we make each other laugh. Mm-hmm. And so we're always quite pleased to see each other. So it's not like we'll schedule meetings and then forget that we should be working, and we'll discuss other things. I mean, all of the designers, him and David Wiener, who did the lights, and Michael, all five of them, we've been doing the show together for 4 years now. And one of the amazing things about this entire collaboration is that we meet as a group, and we shout at each other, or they shout at me, as a group. And so it's not just like, here's the set and here's the sound. We're all in a dialogue all the time. So the idea is that no element is different. So we meet a lot, but Corins and I will meet for, you know, we'll schedule an hour, and then we'll talk about other things. And in the end, I'll go, well, you should move the bed a foot. And he goes, okay. And we've had a meeting. And we couldn't have said that at the beginning of the meeting, but it takes us an hour of knowing each other to get there. So there's an incredible shorthand and an incredible pleasure in each other's company. But I ask, you know, in tech, when you're putting the show together, I want them around me all the time. They're probably sick of me. It's like having a sort of brain. Like, your brain is expanded to all these other people. So I keep them around as much as possible till they're sick of me. And then after that, I still want them around.
The show is primarily a two-hander. You've, of course, directed various sizes of casts. Is your approach any different? Or does it just depend on the project, not the number of people?
I mean, everything depends on the people you're working with and how much time you have. And so, and to do with sort of boring things to do with the rehearsal schedule, like, if there's only two of them, they're there all day. If there are 25 people, you can't keep them there all day. They'll just get resentful and start to make noise. But I remember when I was just starting out as a director, and I thought a great deal of myself. And as I started working with actors who were more experienced than I was, I started learning to be quiet. And that's been a thing I still struggle with, but I'm trying to get better at. If you get Bruce and Laurie, you mostly want to be quiet and let them work it out. So I would sit there and they would sort of figure things out. And then I would go, well, what about this? And so we worked very, very collaboratively. You know, it was a full open dialogue. And then there is at the same time this sort of insane choreography that the show requires. And like, that's how fast this thing's going to move. And that's what the music's going to do. And they are both so adept and so skilled at it that the rehearsals were this sort of very interesting balance of like, directing a musical, no, you have to do that on three because we have to eggs. And Bruce does that like no one I've ever seen. And then being like, well, what do you think this moment's about? How do we explore this? What's happening here? It was different for me because they are different. They're so astonishing that I, you know, wanted to be, polite's not the right word because it wasn't that. It was that you get actors like that, you just don't want to talk very much. And that was sort of how I tried to approach it, was to let them work things out on their own and then come in and sort of try and nudge it, but not come, they don't need some grand vision from me, which is at the same time is weird because like the whole show is a grand vision. So it was a very odd, it's a small intimate two-hander and a kind of behemoth. And so getting that balance right was a new, that most two-handers are just in a room and most behemoths have 25 people. It was a challenge. It took work. It took a lot of people working very, very committedly and very, very hard to make it the thing I hope it is. But that was that everybody gave their all to it, both in the truth of a moment and also in like, oh God, now we have this vast move we have to deal with and you have to get there because otherwise this thing's going to hit you. And we worked on both of those things at once and we got there.
How aware of the production is Stephen King?
Well, I don't know. I got one note from him once. I've never met him. I mean, Bill Goldman speaks very highly of him and loves him. And obviously, he's Stephen King. He's a genius. The only message I've ever gotten from him was that I got a call from one of our producers one day who said, Stephen King wants to give you a note. He wanted to check it was okay first, but he wants to give you a note. And I was like, oh my God, here comes the secret. Stephen King said, tell Will to tell Bruce Willis to scream really, really loud. So that is the extent of my contact with King. I'm desperately hoping he's going to come see it, you know, and I'm terrified that he's going to come see it at the same time. So to let us do it has been so kind of him, and to have written this astonishing book, and then to let us not to change his book shows a real kind of generosity.
When I walked out of the theater after seeing it, there was a huge crowd outside the stage door, some of whom had playbills in their hands, as is the usual at a theater, and many of whom did not, because Mr. Willis is, of course, a movie star. Other than that moment outside the theater after the show, how much does Bruce Willis being a movie star matter?
It matters economically, because he sells a lot of tickets, sure. And in that way, it matters a lot. And also in an interesting way, which is that Bruce understands there are 500 people outside the theater every night who want his autograph. So Bruce understands fandom and understands the oddness and the life of having fans. I don't have any fans. Bruce's knowledge of fans and of being a figure that people love in that way informs his work. He understands Paul and he has a understanding and a sympathy towards Annie that comes from having been in the position Paul Sheldon is in. So that helps a great deal. At the same time, and he's also incredibly charismatic, and you sit there and go, I'm 10 feet from Bruce Willis. You know, I'm 10 feet from Bruce Willis. I'm talking to Bruce Willis. I'm telling Bruce Willis what to do. And that's amazing. This Bruce Willis, you know, I remember cutting school to go see Die Hard. So to be in a room with him and to call him my friend is amazing. Every moment he's been a completely gracious, completely lovely collaborator. In the way that you would expect any actor to behave. Like, he never didn't come to rehearsal. He was never late. He has no airs that I can see. And then every night, at the end of the night, when you've, like, seen your friend Bruce, and then I walk outside, and there's all these people waiting for him, and I go, oh, yeah, that guy who I just am proud to call my friend is also a world-famous celebrity. And I sort of have to remind... I see that crowd, and I remind myself of it. And also, he can be teased about it, which is quite nice. He's important in the culture, and that's a part of him. But as an actor, he pays no attention to it, and so he didn't expect anybody else to. There was no call me Mr. Willis.
So can we talk about Laurie Metcalf?
Yes.
She's she's terrifying, as she should be. Astoundingly good.
I don't really have words to praise Laurie. She's so beyond... She's just breathtaking. She's so clever and so open and so vulnerable and so smart about her performance and so willing to be ugly and then so dazzlingly funny when she wants to be. And so, and in all of that, like, a pleasure to work with as well. A kind of, you know, like, has opinions but listens and is engaged in a sort of an ongoing dialogue with the production, with the text, and then walks out on stage and you just think, that's magic. Nobody can do that. That's beyond. And so I just, and I watch it and I work, you know, I spend all day with Laurie and we talk about things and we work. And then she walks on stage and I think, I've never seen this woman before in my life. This is the strangest person I've ever seen. And there's something about, like, it's all truthful, it's all Laurie, but her ability to inhabit a role. You know, I ran into her backstage at one point and I was sort of like, is she going to remember? Like, I don't know if she's going to know who I am. And she's like, hi, you know, you look tired. Like, it. And then she went on stage and did that. And it's just, I'm in awe of her. She's just that. I mean, they're breathtaking, dazzling, whatever word you want. I've never seen anybody do what Laurie Metcalf does. And she just does that. And she does it twice a day on Wednesdays, you know, and then goes on with her life. It's just, she's just astonishing. I don't know the word for how good I think she is. I just think she's extraordinary.
Will Frears is the director of Misery on Broadway. The production, starring Bruce Willis and Laurie Metcalf, is running at the Broadhurst Theater in New York City through February 14th. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.